Drug pricing is the hottest topic in healthcare, and ICER founder Dr. Steve Pearson is the coolest person to discuss it with. In this episode of the Health Biz podcast, Steve describes how ICER compiles and analyzes clinical evidence to estimate the fair value of treatments for cancer and other serious illnesses. ICER has been especially active during the pandemic. It's developed a pricing model for remdesivir and other COVID-19 therapies. It's being used in the United States and by health technology assessment agencies around the globe. I'm your host, David Williams. Thanks for tuning in, and remember to subscribe to Health Biz. Steve, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you, David.
Excellent. Well, we're going to jump into some real meaty topics, but as a little bit of a warm-up, just tell the listeners about your background, your upbringing, education, what you did before you got to ICER.
Sure. Well, I was actually born in the Midwest, but mainly grew up in Southern California. Went to medical school up at UC San Francisco, and then came out to the East Coast to do my internal medicine residency training at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. And I was thinking about being a kind of classic academic general internist. So I did a fellowship in epidemiology and health services research at Harvard Medical School, and then started a kind of traditional academic track position where I would do part-time clinical, part-time research. But over time, I had become more and more interested in the ethical challenges that I saw in the healthcare system. My outpatient practice and residency was actually at the old Harvard Community Health Plan, where the docs themselves would have a full day of practice and then trot down, you know, to the end room at the end of the day to make a decision about whether to cover Viagra or buy a new MRI machine or hire more nurses. And it just struck me that the trade-offs that they had to deal with and the wrestling with the evidence and the values and all the different factors, I just found it really, really interesting. So that was kind of the early start of my interest in trying to figure out how to bring together the study of the evidence on new technologies in particular with a kind of ethical framework for how do we engage with patients, with clinical experts, with all the different stakeholders. And slowly from that kind of gathered an interest in kind of the structural aspects of how we do this for the U.S.
Well, great. Well, Steve, you're the founder of ICER. And first I have to say, it's a pretty cool name. We're going to have some cool names that we talk about today, but you know, ICER, it sounds like something good, but you know, what is it?
Well, first, I do have to say that I spent a year in Washington as a special advisor at Medicare. And, you know, there were agencies like AHRQ, there were all these other, every agency has some acronym. And I was determined if I was ever going to start something, it was going to have a pronounceable acronym. And ICER kind of grew out of several different permutations, but it was basically started as a research laboratory, to be honest with you. It was an academic project. I was in Washington, but still on faculty at Harvard. And at that point, we had kind of, the Affordable Care Act had passed, and I had been involved in trying to help people think through what we would do with comparative effectiveness research and whether it would involve cost effectiveness research and what would be done with that kind of information. And it just became clear that, you know, the United States was not really headed down a path of having a federal agency trying to do some of the work that I had seen overseas and even, again, some of the better health plans and state programs do here in the U.S. So I wanted to start a research lab. I called it ICER, and we really, really did view it as research. We were experimenting with different ways to talk about evidence, different ways to talk about value, different ways to engage with stakeholders. It was all kind of trying to figure out what would work in the U.S. context with the common mission, though, of providing independent, rigorous assessment of evidence that would inform a more transparent discussion about value, because that was the one thing that it just felt like we were particularly almost uniquely bad at here in the U.S.
Yeah, that is one of our many distinctions of the healthcare system, right? So that's but an important one, and increasingly recognized as so. So when you talk about having a research institute, you know, it also sounds like something that's sort of quiet and usually, you know, you have academic journals and conferences and so on, but it's not generally known. But ICER has actually gotten kind of hot and made its name into the news. Why is that?
Yeah, I think it's for a couple of reasons. I mean, partly it was because we had the chance to stumble around and make a lot of mistakes in our early years and learn and start to put together a process that I think held water and would look more trustworthy to the outside world. And then around came hepatitis C. And with the drugs for hepatitis C, it was like this, and it was obviously in the same time frame that Martin Shkreli and other people were kind of doing things that, that were catching people's attention. But in the background, you know, the payer community, the Medicaid community, the VA, were just reeling with trying to understand what to do. And all of a sudden, off in the distance, there was this little group having public meetings and doing independent assessments and talking about what a fair price would be. And so I think it just, it struck people that, wow, maybe this is helpful. Maybe we need this not just for these drugs, but for a lot of different things. And we weren't set up at all to just look at drugs. We had done most of our work on radiation therapy and other kinds of surgical robots, those kinds of things. But it became evident that the country needed a lot of work on drug pricing. And there we were, independent, funded so that we didn't have big conflicts of interest, putting out work that allowed people to have a very, very open public debate around what a fair price was.
Well, it was an interesting time, as you say, in a special situation where you had the so-called $1,000 pill, right? Which is not necessarily bad. It depends how many, you know, you have to take and what it does for you. And there was such a backlog of hepatitis C patients because there hadn't been a very effective treatment. So all of a sudden there was this just this huge, you know, number of people coming through and a lot paid by Medicaid and other federal source, other government sources.
Yeah. And there, but there had been a building sense. And partly this is, again, one of the conundrums is that we frequently find our attention pivot to look at where there is real innovation, because that's where you often have real cost growth. So when employers started having their C-suite conversations and asking the question, where's my healthcare cost growing most quickly? It was in specialty pharmaceuticals. And that's why a lot of people got started with hepatitis, but there was a pent-up interest in trying to figure out what were the policy levers that could be applied to try to deal with not just prices, but with the overall spending and whether people were getting good value for that spending.
So we're going to come to COVID-19 in just a couple minutes, but beyond Hep C, what are some of the other high-profile areas that you've been involved with in the past few years?
Well, it's kind of been a combination, again, of interesting new drug and also systems of care and insurers that have been, I think, getting more used to weaving our work into their own assessments. So again, just to be clear, every single insurer, every single PBM, every single Medicaid program has to make its own assessment. It's not like they can plug and play somebody else's work. So they do, they look around and they say, what evidence is out there? And they look at it themselves. So, but they do appreciate having an independent kind of deeper dive. So when we were after hepatitis C, there were new drugs for cholesterol called PCSK9 inhibitors. And you know, high cholesterol is a very big problem in terms of the number of patients in the United States. And again, people were kind of overly perhaps sensitized to the cost implications. So our work was picked up there. And again, the PBMs and the payers started to use our work because it was in the public domain as a talking point, as a negotiating tool. And then the VA, which had always been tough in terms of negotiating for lower prices, they said, hey, we're using your reports, but we want to figure out how to use them even more and kind of even more focused way. And slowly, as more and more payers started to pay attention to them and use them in these kind of ad hoc ways, employers and others started to say, can we be more systematic about this and make it part of a benefit design in some way so that if the price doesn't hit a fair value price benchmark, according to ICER, we can do something special with it, either exclude it or put it in a special tier of the formulary or do something with it. Because again, it's the employers and the other health plan sponsors, not the insurers even, the real driving pressure here are the employers who are trying to figure out how to afford the health benefits and make a decent benefit package for their employees.
Can you just give a high level view of the ICER methodology? You know, I think in the US, there's a view, you know, we don't want to have rationing. You don't want to put a value on, you know, what somebody's life is worth. If this thing saves my life, you just pay whatever it takes. But how do you get from there to quote unquote fair value?
Yeah, well, again, value is one of these lovely terms. It means everything and nothing, and it's overused. So we have a very formal, what we call value assessment framework, where we try to say, here's how we put together the different pieces. And a part is just a clear look at the clinical effectiveness information, because sometimes the evidence just isn't there that something new, or it doesn't even have to be new, but just something isn't better than something else. And if you can get a firm grasp on that, The rest is kind of back of the envelope stuff. But we often do find that particularly new treatments offer some benefits, especially for some, you know, patient populations. So that's where cost effectiveness as a technique becomes helpful, because you look over the long term, you create a model, and you try to plug in what data you've got today and really figure out over the long haul how much overall health a new treatment, let's say, is providing compared to the current standard of care. And then the real trick is you have to scale the price to that. So if it's a little bit better, you have a way of saying you can have a little bit higher price. And that's done by assigning a threshold. And this is where people can start to argue, well, how much would we be willing to pay for a better drug? And you can always do a kind of a vaudeville routine where you say, okay, it'll extend your life by 2 weeks and help your itch a little bit. Would you spend $1 million more? Of course not. Of course not. Okay. Once you get that on the table, then we can start to argue about how you do it. And health economists have very fancy ways to justify it. But at the end of the day, it's linked to what's basically called the opportunity cost. If we pay for health at too high a rate, we actually do damage to people that we can't even see in the healthcare system, because the premiums will go up at a rate that will force them to drop their health insurance, and they have negative health effects from there. So you kind of just try to figure out what's the highest price we could pay for the innovation and the added health right here in front of us for these patients without doing more harm somewhere else. And they've been doing this research for 30 years, and it ends up being around $100,000 per additional quality adjusted life year. And that's one of those terms, again, that make people turn blue, red, green, all different colors. But it is the kind of common metric that you need to be able to fairly and consistently compare treatments in all different kinds of treatment areas.
Good. Excellent. Well, that can be its whole own podcast. We may bore people with that one. So I said we would talk about some other cool names. So another cool name, at least, is Remdesivir. And I did a podcast with Surya Singh, who I know works with you some, on Remdesivir. And I think I called it Remdesivir Powers Activate. And that was before the most recent evidence came out about it. So we may call this one something different. But, you know, Remdesivir is treatment for COVID-19. And let's just talk about kind of COVID-19 more broadly, where you've been involved, obviously. What are some of the key issues in pricing therapies, vaccines, and so on for COVID-19?
We don't have enough time in the next decade to probably cover all of that. But the key thing to realize is that a couple of things. One is, I think vaccines and treatments just have very different pedigrees in the development of them, and the way that they're produced and distributed, the way that international groups work together on them. So there's a whole different approach usually to pricing vaccines, and it creates a different dynamic for incentives for innovation, et cetera. So that really is a very different breed of animal, if you will. The acute treatments, the interesting thing is it's almost like a hepatitis C situation again. Now, one of the key features there is that that was essentially a cure. It was certainly viewed as a cure. We don't have anything like that yet, but we do have millions and millions of people, billions around the world, who might need this. So we've got this huge population with immediate need. And now we're trying to say a drug is how much better, and how are we going to figure out what a price is when we need to treat so many people and we want to do it equitably. And the ethics really come into play here. So what was interesting is that we saw this coming, and we knew the evidence was going to be changing every single day in some senses. But the country was already starting to have this debate, and the CEO of that company was being asked, what are you going to charge for it? So we thought, let's put out, again, an independent assessment and see if we can help at least inform that discussion with some evidence. So we did. We looked at it actually two different ways. One is, because this was part of the public debate, how much does it cost just to make the darn thing, to mix the chemicals in a bowl, slap it in a plastic vial, and ship it out to people to use? How much does that cost? And then the other way was the more kind of traditional cost effectiveness route of saying, how much value does it bring to patients? But there were all kinds of fights, and they're still going on around whether the drug does save lives or just helps people get better a little bit faster. How much you factor in the hospital costs and all that kind of thing. So we put out a report before the company did name the price, And Wall Street obviously had all of its estimates in general were like 5 to 10,000, some of them more. And we came out saying it was around 2,800 to 3,000 bucks if you wanted to give it credit for mortality. Mm-hmm. And for some of the other things. And if it didn't save lives, it was going to be worth about 300 or 400 bucks.
Right.
So anyway, as you can imagine, again, ring the bell and let the fights begin. But that's kind of what this is about. This isn't about having one right answer. It's about let's sort this out and have a relatively rational discussion, because this isn't going to be the only treatment that's new for COVID. And it highlights a lot of the other questions that we face every single day when a new cancer treatment's approved or a new treatment for mental health. I mean, this just puts that kind of difficult decision-making really into the public eye.
So with remdesivir, as you were saying, you know, it could shorten hospital stays, which is valuable in and of itself if it can do that, because especially if the hospital capacity is a scarce resource as it has been in a COVID surge. But then the real value to a person is if you actually have more of a chance of surviving. You know, that's what you're saying. And so that's the difference between a few hundred dollars and a few thousand in terms of value. And, the company says that they priced according to the ICER report, but I think they priced assuming that the mortality benefit was there, which it may not be.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of uncertainty, but of one thing I am very certain, and that's that the company did not say they priced their drug because of the ICER report.
Okay.
That there's a history, a good history of companies that are using our reports publicly to help justify their own pricing, but many don't want to hand over the keys to the car just yet. And so I think that we had an important influence on the landscape of what would be viewed as a fair price, because it was rooted in evidence. But I think it's certainly the price came in lower than Wall Street was anticipating. But again, I let others make their own judgment around the specific influence that our report had.
Fair enough. Now let's talk more broadly, because remdesivir, for better or for worse, is not going to be it's not going to be what ends the pandemic. So you've got a broader cost-effectiveness pricing model for COVID-19. So what is this model? And how is it different from the reports and other kinds of outputs that you have generated in the past?
Yeah, we easily confuse people with our own jargon here. But basically, I started off by talking about what our value assessment framework is that looks at the clinical effectiveness, the cost-effectiveness. We also weave in other kinds of benefits beyond health and even ethical issues as part of a larger view. So that's our framework. Each report has all that information in it. And to do cost effectiveness, you have to create a specific economic model for that treatment area. So we now have a model built for acute treatments of COVID-19. And so you can use it to evaluate the cost effectiveness of remdesivir. You could use it when there's better evidence for antibody cocktails or anything else that comes down the pike. This particular model doesn't allow us to look at vaccines. It doesn't kind of go upstream in that sense. But this model is kind of, again, it's a computer simulation. And the timing of it actually fortunately dovetailed with a platform that we're launching actually this month to make all of our economic models on all of our reports available to end users, pharmaceutical companies, hospitals, payers, where they can plug in their own numbers. If they have different kinds of patients, older, sicker, different cost structures, they can put in their own numbers into our model and get a customized version out for them. So we, in particular, put our COVID model out at no charge to other health technology assessment groups internationally. And so now they're being used by other countries as they do their own, again, process of looking not just at remdesivir, but I'm sure at other treatments as they come along.
Now, you point out that the model's being used outside the U.S. by these different, health technology assessment agencies, which we don't really have in the U.S. In the same way that they do. I mean, if you think about, the U.K., they have NICE. Most countries have something that's evaluating and negotiating or deciding what's available. It's kind of weird that is coming from the U.S. where we're actually not known for applying these approaches. But is there something about the U.S. other than just your own idea and the nice ICER acronym that means the U.S. is actually a good place to be starting this from?
I give great credit to the acronym, actually. Except for NICE, we have one of the better acronyms around.
Yeah.
But, no, I think it's a couple of things. One is We do play ball with the other international agencies. Since the U.S. doesn't have a federal group, we've been involved in international health technology assessment policy making and work for many years at the international level. We've actually even led methods development projects with NICE, with Canada, with the Netherlands, Australia, and others. So we're well known. And because we are in the U.S., we often do get the drug approved by our regulatory process, the FDA, earlier than it appears in Europe. And that means that our work is available earlier than theirs. So again, if our work is there, it's trusted, it's transparent, and they can see it, it's easy for them to kind of piggyback or at least to incorporate it into what they do. And again, this cloud-based platform that we're calling ICER Analytics, I think it's going to make it even easier for the international community, in addition to our own kind of national set of stakeholders, to be able to leverage our work. And I think that'll help with a kind of consistency across different countries. It should at least clarify where some of the differences will be. For instance, when Quebec used our model on COVID to look at remdesivir, they pay for their hospitals very differently than we do. And so they plugged in different numbers and they came out with a different finding on the value of remdesivir, which is true. In their system, the way that their government pays for hospitals and doctors, you have to look at it differently.
You know, I think it's interesting. There's both the point that you raise about how we have the therapies here first, so there's more of an opportunity to analyze them. And there's another, some benefit of having ICER not be part of the government. So there's, you know, no doubt about what your focus is. You're informing the debate where there's questions in other countries, at least some, about how independent those assessment organizations are. So I'm a cheerleader and happy to see it doing well. What happens, as you said, you know, we're going to have additional treatments for COVID. So how does a model incorporate the way that the treatments will evolve?
Well, the evidence itself evolves, and we're going to be putting out another update to our remdesivir findings actually fairly soon, because there was a very large international trial called Solidarity that some of your listeners will know about. And so people have been knocking on my door figuratively for a while now saying, when are you going to have another update? But the easy answer is that the way the model is constructed, you can have baked in the use of dexamethasone, which has now kind of been basically become standard of care.
Yeah, that seems to work, huh? What a shock. A steroid is effective. So
yeah, and it's an inexpensive one to boot.
Yeah.
And so you can bake in different assumptions about, you do sometimes have to make assumptions though, and that's true of every model, because we don't have a lot of data yet with remdesivir on top of dexamethasone. So you don't really know whether it's just a mathematical addition of benefit, 2 + 2 = 4. Maybe remdesivir is less effective once you have your steroids already on board. Maybe it's a little bit more. There's some evidence on that, but those are the kinds of assumptions that always make cost-effectiveness a bit of a art, and you have to just try to be as transparent as possible. And again, we're glad that we're going to be able to let people alter some of those assumptions for their own efforts.
And Steve, that I think actually points to an interesting policy approach. So I think in the U.S., the approach would be more likely to give the benefit of the doubt to encourage innovation, to say we might pay for something that's not completely proven, and then over time, maybe we'll see what happens. So, Steve, it's great that you're, you know, kind of ramping up what you're doing with these models, making them available internationally and so on. But I know a lot of people have come to rely on the ICER reports, which you just sort of publish freely on the site. Are those still going to be available?
Oh, absolutely. Our reports are now up to well over, I think, 30,000 PDF pages. So that was part of our interest in making a more digitized format available, just to make it easier for people. So everything will still be completely freely available. We are going to charge a subscription price to the kind of cloud-based platform, but we're going to do it in a way that we think will continue to allow us to be very independent in terms of our conflicts of interest. It's going to be, everything will still be there available in the public eye, so that, again, it can be shared, people can talk about it. And I think that will, again, in our market-based approach involves so much behind closed doors negotiation, with pricing and other terms never being made available. At least having some evidentiary basis for those discussions more freely and widely available, I think is healthy.
You know, you have a lot of constituents involved in ICER. I'm not surprised to see health plans or patient advocacy groups or clinicians involved, but I understand pharmaceutical companies are also involved to some extent using the model. What is their relationship with ICER other than trying to cast doubt on whether there should be a cap on drug prices?
The relationship with the life science industry has been really interesting as it's evolved over time. And again, this is partly influenced by the fact that we are doing a lot more drug reports now than we used to. So, you know, the trade groups, bio and pharma, do not like the idea of anybody having a separate say on pricing. They don't want the government to have its own agency. They don't want ICER to get too much power. That's in their view, it's kind of a privilege that they have worked hard to maintain the pricing power that they have in this country, because we are the only developed country without a federal agency that basically looks at the evidence, negotiates coverage and pricing, and sticks to their guns. We just don't do that. So, but on the other hand, individual companies are in a very different place. And some of them, especially I would say the younger biotech companies, they're almost motivated by the idea of trying to hit a clinical home run and being paid in relation to their ability to do that. And some of them actually don't like being tarred with the same brush with some companies that just seem to make their profits by raising prices on older drugs or by extending patents. So they feel a little bit less, I think, threatened in their core business model by a value-based pricing approach. But again, there are always going to be differences over how you interpret the value to patients and families, trying to capture that, measure it well. But that's a healthier conversation. We had one review of the very first approved gene therapy in the U.S., a gene therapy for childhood blindness, a rare form of it. And to the company's great credit, when we were arguing about what a fair price was with them in the kind of public domain, they were arguing about the evidence and about how it gets translated, how you measure the impact of vision on the quality of life. They weren't saying, hey, back off, we're saving children's sight, we need to innovate, give us the price we want. It wasn't that kind of almost ultimatum around the pricing. And so I thought, as long as we are starting to change the way we debate pricing, we don't have to, and we won't agree, but we're having the right kind of argument for the first time.
No, that makes sense. How do you see the pricing policies evolving in the U.S. if you can actually see? I mean, we're sitting here. I think we're still not sure what's going to be happening in Washington in 2021. But
you're not? I thought it's completely clear now, isn't it?
Well, the Senate isn't clear.
Well, I'm not sure anything's clear yet. But
yeah,
we won't get ahead of our skis. But
no.
The skeptical people in Washington would have told you that it wouldn't have mattered anyway, even if the Democrats had taken the Senate and the White House, that the drug pricing is a very sticky wicket and not a lot of major reform ever gets through. On the other hand, there has been a large hope among many Democratic policymakers that if they had both houses of Congress and the White House, that they could do something big. And something big at least starts with Medicare negotiation in most folks' minds on the Democratic side. Whether that involves negotiating with international reference prices or with some kind of in homegrown American approach to value assessment of a price, I think that is still quite up for debate. And now that it looks more likely, if you had to roll the dice, let's assume a Republican Senate and a Democratic White House, where is their common ground? Where do the Democrats need cost savings to pay for expansions of the ACA? I mean, Washington works in a weird way where often what happens is more driven by vehicles, as they call it, legislative things that have to pass, and pay-fors, where if you need money, you got to find it somewhere and somebody's pocket's going to have that money. So I think it's way, way too early to know what we would get out of a Republican Senate and a Democratic House and White House. But my guess is that we will continue to take baby incremental steps over time. This is America. We rarely do huge, you know, shape-changing initiatives like the Affordable Care Act. We do it sometimes. But on drug pricing, my guess is it will continue to go forward. And I think that may mean that the states take more of a leadership role, which they've already been doing actually over the past couple of years. And in the private market, again, if COVID basically decimates the profits of a lot of employers in this country. And they're having that tough talk around how they're going to afford health benefits next year. I think we're going to see some blunt, but hopefully some more nuanced approaches to saving money, not just in healthcare, not just in drugs, but across the board. So I think we're all going to have to wait and see how the economy influences the debate around drug pricing.
Steve, I'm very happy that you're joining my podcast here, but I know ICER is launching its own podcast. What's the focus there?
I had this brilliant young physician who said, you know what, your work is awesome, and the average practicing doc has no clue. And he said, let's see what we can do about that. Let's do, and he's a podcast maniac, so and a brilliant guy. And so he invited me to basically have a series, I forget if it's 8 or 9 episodes, in which we basically talk not just about kind of broader policy issues, but we do a little bit of a 101 on how did drugs get made and how do they get priced and distributed, just to know a little bit about that. But how does it affect the doc and the patient in the office? And what can a doctor do to learn about it and to be active in that broader national conversation about pricing and coverage? So it was a real delight, and it is available. The episodes are starting to be made available now.
Excellent. I look forward to listening to those. So you've been doing a lot of writing, a lot of podcasting, model building, and so on. Any time for reading?
Yes. And do not ask me why, but I've been reading Paradise Lost. I don't know if that's because I've needed something to take me completely out of my brain. And
yes,
almost like reading a foreign language. But I encourage people, I guess it's kind of like Shakespeare. It's harder than Shakespeare for me. But after you keep reading it a little while, you get over the hump and it starts to feel like your second language in a kind of a cool way. So I love his ability as a blind author at that stage in his life to visualize paradise, and just the texture of his language is refreshing. And the larger issues of justice and God are enthralling to me.
Good. Well, those are the big ones. You don't shy away from it. So that's good. Well, Steve Pearson, it's great to speak with you, founder and president of the Institute for Clinical and Economic Review, otherwise known as ICER. It's been terrific having you on the show.
David, what a pleasure. And thank you so much with your work too.
You've been listening to the Health Biz Podcast with me, David Williams, president of Health Business Group. I conduct in-depth interviews with leaders in healthcare, business, and policy. If you like what you hear, go ahead and subscribe on your favorite service. While you're at it, go ahead and subscribe on your second and third favorite services as well. There's more good stuff to come, and you won't want to miss an episode. If your organization is seeking strategy consulting services in healthcare, check out our website, healthbusinessgroup.com.